Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It is my great pleasure to introduce Ellen Hughes. Ellen is one of the most loved faculty members of UCSF. She hates it when I say things like this. She tried to make me promise to make a very brief introduction to say something like, "Here's Ellen," but I'm going to toot her horn just a little bit. Ellen had gotten a PhD in cell biology, but despite that, when she came to UCSF and got her MD and then her internal medicine residency, she became enamored somehow with primary care, with the kind of medicine where you connect with other people. Ellen is a great lover. I think maybe that's how I would describe her. She loves everybody. Made her a little nervous there for a minute. Ellen was one of the founders of one of the most prestigious parts of UCSF, the Academy of Medical Educators. She was also one of the really guiding forces and instigating forces that led to the development of the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine. She was the first director of the Osher Center when she couldn't look around and find somebody else to draft into that, but she eventually found Susan Folkman to do that. Susan is just now about to retire. Ellen was the Osher Center's Director of Education for many years. Ellen retired herself about a year ago. Most of us are still grieving that just a little bit, but she does agree to come back now and then. Ellen is a fabulous speaker. She's getting nervous that I'm spending up too much time. All right. And she's also my very good friend. So here's Ellen.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good luck on the play.
Thank you. And this is for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. This is actually a talk I've gotten the most out of myself personally in researching, so I'm really excited to be able to share with you some information tonight about trying to live better, not just longer. So let's get started. So I'm going to start actually with a little bit of background, not just the definition of aging, but what we're learning from a lot of the studies in the medical and scientific literature. Everything from studying people who successfully age all the way down to test tube work with genes. Much of that work is actually being done here at UCSF, so I'm really excited to be able to share that in the context of how that impacts what you and I should and maybe could benefit from in terms of aging gracefully as we grow older. The last part of the talk will be condensing a lot of the information that I've been studying into 10 basic recommendations for aging as successfully as possible. So let's get started. So aging, despite the anti-aging industry, is actually a natural, non-pathological process that affects all of us. And in the United States, our life expectancy is twice what it was of our grandparents at the turn of the century. So an average child born today can expect to live to the late 70s. The longest is in Japan, and we're actually going to say something about some of the lessons we've learned from the Japanese who are so long-lived. The shortest, sadly, is in Africa, in Sierra Leone. So you can see there's quite a huge difference in life expectancy depending upon where you're born. And one in five Americans will be greater than 65 years old by 2030. So the population is definitely graying. So how we learn about aging is a couple of different levels. I think people naturally will be wanting to study looking at successful societies, and there are some unique societies where people tend to live longer, healthier lives. There are several centenarian studies being done in this country and across the world studying people who've made it to 100 and what is it that allows them to be so successful. We aren't so much going to be touching base about people who with accelerated aging or twin studies, but those are also part of the information we learn about going through our lifespan. Much of the work we're going to talk about tonight is animal-based and lots of very interesting studies. And then finally, some very exciting work in terms of genes. There may actually be some longevity genes, which should have a great interest for anybody who's growing older. So where are the societies where people live the longest? And I mentioned already that Japan has one of the oldest, and the island of Okinawa is supposedly the best place to be born if you want to live a long, healthy life. Some of you may have seen this, the blue zones, or read about it. It was actually highlighted on Dateline, I think, this last week. And this is somebody who's written a book. They've gone to these various places across the world and really sort of just looked at what were the factors that allowed the people to thrive, to be healthy into their 80s, 90s, and even 100. So Okinawa was one of them. Crete, in this country, it was a place in Southern California where there's a large percentage of Seventh-day Adventists. Costa Rica, and they've added some other places as well. Throughout the night, I'll be weaving in some information that this researcher has discovered. And I mentioned centenarian studies. There's one in Baltimore, and they're following greater than 100,000 people who are 100 years or older in this country. I mean, and in fact, the very old is the most rapidly increasing level of or group of aging people. Now, many of these people do lead healthy lifestyles. About a third of them seem to just gracefully go through. They don't get the same chronic diseases many people in our families have gotten. Their children live longer as well, so there must be something. And many of them do live healthy lifestyles, but some don't. So that's the big question is why you always read sometimes when somebody's 108 and they say, well, it's that whiskey and that cigarette I've been smoking. And you just go, wait a second, that doesn't fit with everything I've heard about how to, you know, make it to 100. So what allows some of these people to live so long? And this is, I think, the most exciting scientific finding in the last decade. So there are some model organisms, and they have found that there are some genes in each of these organisms that seem to affect how long the organism lives, and that you, if you can alter that gene, you can actually increase or decrease their lifespan. So you're not all going to become PhD scientists, but Tetrahymena and yeast are, you know, very basic organisms. This worm in the middle is something that I'm going to come back to. It's C. elegans, and one of the world's best researchers in aging, Cynthia Kenyon, studies the lifespan of these worms, and she found that there was a genetic pathway where if she altered it, the worms lived twice as long, just simple gene, a single, you know, genes involving some things about how insulin works in the body. Fruit flies, mice, and this weird-looking organism to the right, the naked mole rat. That looks like a Halloween figure to me. So let's go back. So what are the old theories of aging where we just sort of wore out like an old car? We'd end up looking like this in the junkyard. Our parts got worn out. We didn't get the oil changed. Even when we did, it finally just gave up the ghost. But I think that wear and tear hypothesis is not the full picture, and maybe not even part of the full picture. So I'm going to briefly talk to you about some of the theories about why we do age. One of them is oxidative stress, calorie restriction, telomeres, which Liz Blackburn just got the Nobel Prize from UCSF, and then finally a little bit more specifically about these longevity genes. So oxidative stress. So when you buy your multivitamin that has an antioxidant, this helps explain what that's about. So in the body, we need to be able to convert the food we eat into energy that our body can use, and that's ATP. And that occurs in these little organelles called mitochondria in every cell of our body. And that's great. We need the ATP to live. But as a side effect of this process, metabolism, there are these sort of nasty actors, reactive oxygen and nitrogen species that are not good, and they actually can damage DNA and proteins and lead to the dysfunction of cells, organs, and ultimately the organism. And so that's sort of the dark side of just having to be a person who needs energy to live. So antioxidants are substances that people take to help counteract the reaction of these reactive oxygen and nitrogen species. So that's one thing to think about. Look at these two monkeys. They're the same age, and the one on the left looks pretty, you know, reasonable. The one on the right has been allowed to eat as much monkey chow as he wanted for his life. No, you know, you just give monkey chow and they'll eat what they want. Well, the one on the left was given a third less than the amount of the one on the right, and he's living a third longer. And this has been something that's been observed in everything from these worms to very small organisms all the way up to the level of non-human primates and maybe even humans. We're going to see more about it. So animals who were given a third less calories, none of us wants to hear this, live longer, and they don't just live longer, they live healthier. They do not develop the same age-related diseases at the same rate. They're less insulin resistant, and this sort of makes sense. Insulin is the hormone, you know, that takes sugar that we get in our body into the cells. The more sugar, the more insulin, and there's something not so good about having too much of either of those around. And there's a slower decline in functional status. Now, I need to make the point, this is not eating disorder type calorie restriction. This is healthy, balanced nutrition, just less of it. Does that make sense? So this is not an anorectic monkey. This is a monkey who was given appropriately balanced nutrition, just less of it than he or she would have normally eaten during the day. And there's a whole bunch of people in the United States that have voluntarily chosen to do this. They're members of something called the Calorie Restriction Society. They've written a book called The Longevity Diet, and they are putting their money on the fact that this research in other animals is going to apply to them as well. So they eat about 30 to 40% fewer calories, very balanced. And there's actually now an ongoing observational study of people from this society who volunteered, because it's very difficult to randomize people to this kind of a program. Although there is this study, the Calorie Study, Comprehensive Assessment of Long-Term Effects of Reducing Energy of Intake of Energy, that it's a two-year study, and they've actually gotten people in New Orleans to agree to follow this lifestyle. And the preliminary results are pretty remarkable, at least in terms of insulin levels being lower and many other things that would be associated with aging. The full two-year study is not yet out in print. So we're going to have to wait a while for this data to come through, but there are lots of supporting other levels of evidence that indicate we probably are eating too much, and we're probably eating too much of the wrong kinds of foods. So why would this work? Well, remember I just said that when you eat, you have to make energy and transport it. So maybe it's less oxidative stress for the cells. Maybe it also means your body has to make less insulin. But there's also this new family of proteins some of you may have heard about called sirtuins. I just want to take a couple of slides to show you what these are. So sirtuins are the products of genes that get triggered when somebody's not eating as many calories. And I've got the resveratrol in that beautiful glass of Cabernet there for a reason, because resveratrol is a substance that triggers the production of these sirtuin-type proteins. And when they gave very, very high doses of resveratrol to chubby mice, mice that were unhealthy, they actually started to appear younger. They started to live longer. They started to have less of the metabolic problems associated with obesity. So everybody's thinking, this might be, you know, a really good thing to research and a great thing to consider starting a company for. And sure enough, that happened. David Sinclair at Harvard started something called Sirtris Pharmaceuticals to research resveratrol and resveratrol-like substances that will help trigger these special proteins that seem to be good for the obese mice and maybe good for many other things, including cancer, obesity, diabetes, let alone aging in general. And just another large pharmaceutical company felt the potential in this field was large enough that they paid a fairly large amount of money in 2008 to purchase Certrus. So now it is part of this larger conglomerate. So we've talked a little bit about proteins, a little bit about genes. Let's talk a little bit about aging at the cellular level. Any of you have ever been in a laboratory, have seen Petri dishes, and know that when people try to grow cells, fresh cells, on a Petri dish in the lab, they actually, unless they undergo a certain kind of transformation, die after a certain period of time. And there seems to be about 50 cell divisions seems to be about the time that the cells don't can't continue to divide in culture. And it was called the Hayflick limit. Again, actually, Leonard Hayflick worked here at UCSF. And why might that be? Well, that leads us to the story of telomeres that I'm sure some of you heard about with the recent Nobel Prize awarding. Telomeres are like the ends of chromosomes. And as genes divide and chromosomes have to divide, they tend to get a little bit frayed, a little bit shortened with stress or with age. So you want your telomeres to be protecting the ends of your chromosomes. So these are, again, DNA protein complexes which stabilize the ends of chromosomes. They shorten. They're shorter in people that are older. They're shorter in people with disease, and they're shorter in people who are undergoing chronic stress. And they lengthen, which is kind of interesting. You can actually show that they can get healthier or longer in response to good things like healthy lifestyle, stress management. So this is going to be an area, I think, that many, many people are interested in looking at. I predict in the next 5 years you're going to go to your primary care doctor and you're going to get your telomere length estimated, and then you're going to go on a drug or do a lifestyle thing, and a couple months later, 6 months later, whatever, you may get your telomeres checked again as a measure of how well you're doing and the health-related benefits to what changes you've made.
Question.
Yeah.
What is the proper name of the journal that you're referring to?
Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It's one of the most prestigious. Sorry, it was too long to type in, but that's a great article. This is an amazing article. So this was also done here locally with Liz Blackburn in collaboration with Dean Ornish. Many of you are aware has done huge work with, you know, lifestyle modification, particularly a very low-fat diet. So this was 31 men who had low-grade, low-risk prostate cancer. And as you know, prostate cancer in some men grows very, very slowly. And if you're first diagnosed with a low-grade cancer, many men actually choose what we call watchful waiting, because having immediate surgery or treatment doesn't always impact their lives in a positive way. So this was 31 men with low-risk cancer who were followed this Ornish lifestyle program that involved exercise, the low-fat diet, stress reduction, and a little bit of yoga. And they did this for 3 months. And then they did, some of you may not be familiar with this, but this green and red kind of sparkly picture at the top are what are called gene arrays. So they were able to check the genes that were active before the men started the program and afterwards. And what they found in just 3 months of a lifestyle change, 500 or more genes were either turned on or turned off in a healthy direction, meaning genes that were controlling tumor formation, oxidative stress, and inflammation, all of which are bad, were downregulated, less active after the program, and others that we believe are more health-promoting were stimulated. So this was pretty mind-boggling that in 3 months you could see this kind of genetic change with just making lifestyle change. The bottom graph shows you also their telomere length. We had no idea that the telomeres could change in such a short period of time. We don't know whether this could happen in a month because the study hasn't been done yet. But at least at 3 months, the very positive message here is you make a lifestyle change, you change your genes in a very short period of time. So I just want to finish this part about the basic science by saying at a conference I went to recently at Harvard, there are probably three or four or five other longevity pathways, not just the insulin one, not just the sirtuin one, and there are feelings that maybe each of these is cross-communicating with each other. So although they haven't reached the popular press yet, I think we're just at the beginning of a very, very exciting period in science that's going to have a great impact on how we age. So I think it's just really going to be the tip of the iceberg. And this was just one way to say it is a complicated, exciting process. And I don't expect you to, I'm not even going to go through this all, but I think there are many, many different things that affect how we age at a cellular and organismal level, and I think we're going to know a lot more in the next 5 to 10 years. So what does this all mean to you? What does all this basic science mean to you? And I think the truth is nobody yet has discovered a way to reverse aging. That's, I think everyone would love to. Can't I keep the wisdom that I have now and go back to the body of that 25-year-old who could do more? Oh, boy, that would be wonderful. So we don't yet have a way to reverse aging. But some of the data I'm going to present to you in this next part of the talk says there is a huge amount we can each be doing to make ourselves healthier and live better, not just longer. So I love these two quotes. There's the concept of dying young as late as possible, because you really do. You'd like to be functioning and active and mentally aware and then, you know, get your illness and go quickly would be my wish. So that's also the concept of compressed morbidity, so that you don't have a 10-year slow decline and a really not the quality of life that you would like. So I just want to say a word about the anti-aging industry. There are huge amounts, and this is a picture that I always get in the United Airlines magazine. I don't know. He's Dr. Life. I don't know him personally, but he underwent, you know, one of these anti-aging programs, and he looks pretty wonderful as a result. The sad part is many of these programs support healthy lifestyle, great, but they also do a lot of hormone replacement. And their belief is that as these hormones drop as you age, you should just supplement them and you'll do fine. There's really no data to support these fountain of youth claims, and there may actually be some dangers associated with replacing some of these hormones. So I just, though, want to say you have to have a skeptical attitude when you read some of these ads. But there are actually many excellent guides to aging available, and I think these three are three that I would highly recommend. Andrew Weil wrote this book back in 2002, and it's breathtaking. I read it again to prepare for this talk, and in 2002, he was already talking about telomeres and the different sorts of scientific bases for what I'm going to say. So, and there are a fair number of websites also that will help you. Have any of you tried or gone to the one called realage.com? Okay, so let me tell you what that's about. This was based on some of Mike Roizen, Dr. Roizen's findings, and it brings together all of the things that I'm going to be talking about. What you do is you sit at the computer, and it'll say, okay, what's your blood pressure? What's your weight? How big is your waist? You know, how much exercise do you get? And they put these all into a formula, and they give you what they consider to be your functional age, not your biological age. Some of you may have seen on Oprah, you know, people have come in and said, had this test done, and they're 50, but they're really 66 by functional status. Then they get religion and go do a lifestyle thing, and then they're now 48. I mean, it actually, for whatever it is, I think it's a really good thing to let people know that what they do in their life really has an impact on their health, and that there are people who are 65 who are functioning at the level of a 48-year-old because luck, you know, good lifestyle, whatever. So these are good websites to visit. One of the other sorry. I'm sorry. It's if you just Dr. Michael Roizen, and if you just look at it under "You Staying Young," you can get it on Amazon. So this is another really positive piece of information, which surprised me. What really determines your health? Because many of us feel like, oh, I just got mom's genes. I'm going to be fat the rest of my life. There's diabetes in my family. Why care? And genes are clearly really important. But in some studies, when they've looked at what are the various contributors, genes are really about a third of our health. And look at this. Behavior is more influential. 40% of your health may be attributable to the things you choose to do for your health. Clearly, you want to be in a healthy environment. You'd like to have social contact. We'll talk more about that at the end. And having good health care would certainly be helpful. But the biggest slice of this pie is behavior. So even though it's kind of hard once in a while to get up off the couch, it is really in the power of every single one of us to have a huge impact on our own health and maybe the health of our families. So I just wanted to briefly say why I think changing your lifestyle changes your genes. Remember, we just talked about those prostate cancer patients. Well, there's a whole new field called epigenetics. And we used to think, you know, the genetic code, you know, gets transmitted from generation to generation. Well, what they found is that what we do in our lifetime impacts our genetic material in a way that's not just dependent on the sequence, but on how the chromatin is packaged, how it's modified. And those changes are very, very profound. So here again, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but we're now understanding at a sort of test tube level, why is it that getting up and exercising, why is it that eating a healthy diet may actually have such a profound effect on your genes? So as we understand those mechanisms, I hope it's an inspiration and something of hope to you. But we are not leading very healthy lifestyles. This was a survey of over 150,000 U.S. adults, and only 3% said they could answer yes to each of these things, that they didn't smoke, they were a healthy weight, they ate their five fruits and veggies a day, and they exercised regularly. I mean, this should be the bottom line basic health prescription that you should be getting from your physician and that you should be incorporating into your life. And that's, if only 3% of us is doing it, that's not a very positive finding. So we're not going to focus on all the unhealthy behaviors that you know about, but I clearly need to list them. Smoking, drinking, using drugs, risky behavior is all not good. But I would like to focus on the positive aspects of what you can do for your health in addition to getting rid of some of these unhealthy behaviors. So here's my 10 recommendations, and we're just going to start going from 1 to 10. Maintain a healthy weight. Nobody who walks the streets or rides a bus is going to be surprised that two-thirds of us are overweight, a third of us are obese. A third of a million U.S. adults are believed to die prematurely because of obesity-related disease. And it's not surprising. We evolved at a time when there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, there wasn't a McDonald's down the block. So if you and your ancestors were not hardwired to eat when there was food, to have a really healthy appetite, and to hold on to those calories as fat, you and I wouldn't be here today. So sometimes people call them the thrifty genes, and there are certainly some families that don't have them. My family has it in spades where, you know, it's you overeat, you under-exercise, and there you are. You're packing it away, you know, in places you don't want to. So, and on top of it, in the last 10, 20, 30 years, we are consuming huge numbers of extra calories than our grandparents did. And sadly, we need fewer calories as we age. I've mentioned in one other talk, I think it was a year or two ago, as we age, we naturally lose muscle mass, even if you're pretty active. And muscle's the most metabolically active tissue. So the bad news is, let's say you're 20, I'm just going to make up a number, and you need 2,000 calories to maintain your weight. By the time you're 30, maybe you only need 1,800 calories. By the time you're 50, maybe you really only need 1,700 calories. So you're fighting this sort of battle of needing fewer calories as you age because you're naturally losing muscle mass. So all of these things together have added into an obesity epidemic. And truthfully, I think one of the major culprits is portion size. Many of you who saw Super Size Me saw the effects of, you know, taking the extra sized Big Mac for just even a period of a month. So here are some strategies. So actually, let me, before I go on with the specific strategies, the Okinawans that in the Blue Zones, they say a little affirmation before each meal. It's called the 80% rule. And they, before they sit down and eat a meal, 80% full, they stop, or at least intend to stop, when they're 80% full, not, you know, Thanksgiving dinner type, you know, roll yourself out. So they actually are aware, and as a result, and maybe other cultural things, they eat on average 1,000 calories less per adult than we do in this country. So, yeah.
I have a question. I'm backpedaling a little bit.
Okay.
Those studies where they reduce the calories by,
yes,
80%.
Yes.
The people who started at the beginning of those studies, were they overweight?
No, not necessarily. Very good question. So let me repeat it. In the calorie restriction, you know, the people that are choosing to follow that, certainly weight loss is a side effect of doing that kind of a program, but many of them were not obese, and that was not their original intention. They will lose weight, and you will lose excess body fat by following that regimen, but they're doing it with the goal of hopefully having a healthier, longer life.
So if you're already struggling with being underweight, you probably can't.
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, that would be a little bit more complicated, because you'd have to really, really make sure you had healthy, adequate nutrition, really, really good balance, so you weren't, you know, going so low that you weren't getting essential nutrients. Okay, so what are some strategies? There's some restaurants in San Francisco that will serve you a half portion. So if I found, I can't remember which one it was, but I said, okay, would you just serve me half of it and bring the rest in a doggy bag? Because I'm the kind of, where I was raised, I don't know about you, eat your, you know, everything on the plate, and it's a nice night, I've had a glass of red wine, oh, that extra piece of bread looks great, and I end up eating more than I need to. So up front, I know that if I'm given half an entree, I'm going to probably feel satisfied. So splitting entrees is a great idea. Smaller plates, this is fascinating. They, you know, have you ever been to buffets and you get this little tiny thing and you think they're being cheap? They're not. They're helping you with your health. If you go from a 10-inch plate to an 8-inch plate, you eat a third less. When you're not told ahead of time that this is an experiment on calorie restriction. So at the buffet, you get the small plate, you feel like you're filling it up. You may go back for seconds, but you instinctively, many people will eat less. So there have been a couple of experiments where they've literally gone into families and just replaced the plate size, and it's made a difference in terms of weight loss. And then these final things are for people who really can't manage to understand portions. These are actually pretty remarkable. And if you just used like this plate down to the left for a week, you'd be astounded at what a portion of meat really is. It's like this minuscule little thing in a cup. The difference between this and the plates that are just marked with, you know, don't put more protein than this, is that you can still stack a whole lot of food on those other plates. This, it's going to show you, because it's like a little cup. Fascinating, the things that are helping people. Okay, we're going to not have time to go through in great, great detail every one of them, but I just want to touch the surface. So exercise, no-brainer. 60% of us don't exercise regularly. 25% are couch potatoes, and we burn 800 fewer calories a day than our grandparents did at the turn of the century. And that's pretty astounding, given that a pound of fat is 3,600 calories. It's not going to take a whole lot of days of eating 800 calories more, or not exercise, you know, the combination of eating and not exercising. So you all probably are aware that the national recommendation, minimal recommendation for moving every day, is about 30 minutes of moderate intensity exercise. Let me translate that for you. Most of the time people say that's brisk walking. So that's not walking, you know, like down in the mall. That is clip walking, 3 to 4 miles an hour. So if any of you remember Stayin' Alive from the Bee Gees, I am not going to subject you to my version of Stayin' Alive. But that is 100 beats a minute, and that's the pace you should be walking for your moderate intensity brisk walking. So Stayin' Alive. You know, so that's it's not sauntering. So this is the minimum you should be doing. And the problem is, and everybody's got 24/7 stresses. How the heck do you get to the gym to do this? And a lot of us just don't have the luxury of getting there. So the key that I see is you have to integrate it into your life and be creative about it. Park further away. Take the stairs. Get off a stop early. Walk on breaks. I, in fact, when I semi-retired, had the option of continuing to pay for a very expensive parking permit that would get me just to the one office, or I could pay a third as much and park 10 blocks away up a big hill. Well, I chose because I'm cheap, and also I knew if I didn't have that built in. So now I guarantee that I have to walk 10 blocks down and 10 blocks back to my car every time I go into work. That I just knew that if I didn't do that, I might not get as many steps in. Trying to exercise with friends, if that's something that helps you, work with a personal trainer if the resources are there. Set a goal. When I turned 60, I decided I wanted to go a very long backpacking trip. So that whole year, every time I felt like a couch potato, I knew that I would feel horrible on the trail if I didn't go out and exercise. Sure enough, I finished this long backpacking trip. I turned into a couch potato again. So I found out that the only way for me to stay consistently motivated is to plan a backpacking trip that's long every summer. And no, I'm serious. For me, that's what works. So if it's for you to walk, you know, a half marathon with your kids, or to do the AIDS walk, or to do something, if setting a goal helps you, do it. And getting a pedometer, for those of you who are data-driven, is great. They're available pretty cheaply. The recommendation is 10,000 steps a day. And when they've put pedometers on people, they found that they actually walked a mile more, the equivalent of 2,000 steps more a day. And they actually did lose a little bit of weight. So whatever you can do to make exercise a positive, integrated part of your life, the better. And it's never too late. This was a study of really elderly, almost 8,000 older women, and they looked at them over 12 years. Certainly those that were really active and stayed active did great. Those who were couch potatoes and didn't get off the couch did the worst. They had a higher level of mortality. But anybody who then got, you know, inspired, who'd been not active but then shifted to the active mode, had the same mortality as the people that had been active their whole life. And sadly, the people who had been pretty active but then got less so, they had the same mortality of people that just had never exercised. So this is kind of use it or lose it, but the good message here is it's never too late. Okay, stay mentally active. So the whole theory used to be your brain is optimized at about age 25 to 27, and it's downhill from there. You don't make any more neurons, no more connections, too bad. And that the data is really different now. We now know that you can make new neurons, and it's like anything, you have to exercise it to help that process happen. So learning something new, picking up a new musical instrument that you wish you'd studied, you know, when you were younger, playing video games, you know, staying a part of your bridge group, anything that keeps you, doing Sudoku, doing the crossword puzzle, anything that keeps you mentally active. And I just want to share with you, this was a fabulous woman I met when I was backpacking last summer, Lynn. She's 75. And she read this talk and has been living it. She has been very active her whole life, had actually breast cancer, and was on some drugs that were really difficult for her to manage for another cancer. But it hasn't kept her from getting out and doing the thing she loves the most, which is backpacking with her husband. And at the age of 68, she took up the cello. You know, I'm going, come on. And she's just happy. She said, I'm not quite as good, I'm sure, as if I'd taken it up at age 9. But she now has a group that she plays with. So it's just, when I asked her permission to talk about her, I was so inspired when I met her and said, you're really a poster child for staying active both physically and mentally. And there are actually now brain fitness programs. Have any of you seen these when you've been in, if you look at the KQED, you know, pledge drives, they're often prizes or offered if you sign up. Huge industry, $225 million in 2007. And actually when they put older people into these programs, put them in front of a computer and have them do these brain fitness programs, they get better memory. They process things better. So I think this is another way to say that staying mentally active is a really important thing and a good thing. So this one's not quite so intuitive. Reduce inflammation. Let me talk you through it. So inflammation is the process in our body that helps protect us against foreign invaders, infection, and injury. It sometimes feels bad when you get an inflamed joint, but that's your immune system doing its job. But the dark side is that if there's too much inflammation, that's not good for your health. And this, it's now called the secret killer, and people are now realizing that inflammation, chronic low-grade inflammation, is probably one of the foundational causes of many of the chronic diseases we're worried about getting, certainly heart disease, probably diabetes, Alzheimer's. So there's thoughts about we want inflammation to be the healthy inflammation, but we don't want it to be too much. So let's talk about some strategies about reducing it. We're going to talk about the anti-inflammatory diet, some of you may have heard about, and flossing your teeth. We just talked about exercise, and I'm going to finish with some stress management. So
could you just give examples of what's inflammation and health?
Okay, so you get a cut and it gets infected. So it gets red, hot, swollen, and painful. That's because all the immune cells are coming to that place to try and fight off the infection, and sadly it causes redness, swelling, warmth, and pain. So that's one form of inflammation. But every time that happens to me, I mean, you obviously don't want to be getting an infected cut. But I realize I usually say, thank you, you know, that's my immune system. That's working. So does that answer your question?
What I'm asking, do all of us here have inflammation?
Yes.
Because we have a bad back or our neck hurts?
Yeah, at one level. So inflammation, yes. Inflammatory processes are going on in a healthy way and sometimes an unhealthy way in all of us. And in fact, people who can't mount an inflammatory response don't do well at all. So it is an important thing, but not in some circumstances. So I love Michael Pollan. Have any of you read In Defense of Food? Oh, these 8 words are probably the healthiest recommendations for any kind of nutritional advice. Eat real food, not too much, mostly plants. So real food is something your grandmother would recognize. Something that doesn't come in a package. Something that doesn't have 5 ingredients you can't pronounce, and probably something that's sold in the middle part of the grocery store. So real food, food that's not all processed. Yeah.
He has addended that with 4 new words, more leaves, fewer seeds.
I like that. Thank you. Yeah. More leaves, fewer seeds.
Why is that?
So we could... Do you want to answer?
Seeds are grains. Typically, we get them simple carbohydrates, even complex carbohydrates. I'm saying we need more micronutrients through leaves and essentially vegetables.
Green leafy vegetables and not so much carbohydrates. We'll talk a little bit more about carbohydrates in a second. So let me say, what's this anti-inflammatory diet? Well, almost what you're saying is true. So you want a diet that's high in nutrient-dense, plant-based whole foods. You want them not to have a lot of simple carbohydrates. That's like sugar, white flour, and we're going to say I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. You don't want saturated fats, trans fats, additives, and you want a fair amount of the good healthy fats, the omega-3 fatty acids, and you really don't want it to be terribly processed. So most of you have heard about glycemic index, some of you. Let me just talk you through it, because actually... So glycemic index, if you eat a certain unit of a food and then they measure how quickly sugar, glucose, spikes in your blood afterwards, that's a measure of a high glycemic index food. So some of their things like white bread, baked potatoes, pure glucose are high. And look at this, low glycemic index, yay, plants, are all the most fruits and vegetables, whole grains, not just whole wheat, but whole grains, brown rice, and other very low carbohydrate substances. So why is this important? Well, when you spike your glucose, you then need more insulin. And remember what I said about those worms? They found, in fact, Cynthia Kenyon just literally published this week. I was at the library making sure I got all the latest data for you tonight. She added 2% glucose to her little worms, 20% shorter lifespan. And guess who with all of her work is now following a complex carbohydrate, mostly plant-based diet? It's Cynthia Kenyon, because she's looked at these worms for all these years. So
where do nuts fit?
Okay, so we're going to talk, because I'm going to talk about Mediterranean diet in a second. So let me just tell you why whole grains are so good and why they make the glycemic index less is because they have all this bran and this covering so that when the enzymes are coming to digest them, they kind of come up against this covering that doesn't allow them to get to the really carbohydrate-rich part of the endosperm. So you've got like a covering that slows how that gets distributed into the system. So that's why whole grains, things that are still covered by bran, are lower in glycemic index than white flour, for instance. So, and what happens when you eat a high glycemic index food? I bet this is not an uncommon experience here. The reward center lights up in your brain. Oh my goodness, this tasted nummy. You eat more. You sometimes get hungry soon afterwards because the sugar goes right up. You get this kind of buzz, and then it goes right down. And the food industry really knows that. David Kessler, who was our former dean, just wrote this great book called The End of Overeating. And the food industry adds in things like sugar, fat, and salt because those are the things that add up, make your reward center light up. And literally, just tonight, I found this other study. So they gave rats, after they were eating a healthy diet, they gave them junk food. Do you know how long it took? So they started to love the Twinkies and the fatty stuff. And within 5 days, they were overeating up to twice the number of calories they would normally. And their reward center damped down. They got so used to the crummy diet that they had to eat more to satisfy the reward center. So they became obese pretty quickly. It took only 5 days for some of these changes to happen when they were given the crummy diet. And when they took them off the crummy diet, it was weeks before it came back to normal. So our food industry sure knows this. Some of us are a little bit more susceptible to this kind of stuff than others, but these are not good actors because they really do make our reward centers light up. So one of the diets that's been touted as very healthy, a healthy alternative, and part of this is also that these are people in Sardinia and Crete that follow a Mediterranean diet that are long-lived. So what are the aspects of that are common features? So mostly fruits and vegetables, lots of beans, nuts, and seeds, the healthy fats, olive oil, little bit of dairy, fish, and poultry, very minimal red meat, couple of eggs and the red wine. But if you look at what this pyramid looks like, they're mostly low glycemic index foods and then high fiber and high nutrient dense foods. And let's go look and see what the data is about Mediterranean diet. It's pretty good. So these are observational studies. They're just saying we look at people who eat a Mediterranean diet, and this is what we see. But 9% reduction in overall mortality, in cardiovascular events, in cancer incidence and mortality, Alzheimer's. A recent study just said 30% reduction in depression that I didn't have time to put on the slide. Reduction in something called the metabolic syndrome, which is often the precursor to diabetes, and it's really a tasty diet. So that's, I just want to leave anti-inflammatory diet, just to also acknowledge that many other cultures have diets that are equally healthy. Many aspects of the Asian diet are just as healthy, many aspects of a healthy Hispanic diet. So I'm not saying the Mediterranean is the only one. It happens to be the one that we have the most data on. And it's one that I think the principles of the Mediterranean diet will apply in other cases. So why am I putting flossing in this lecture? Nobody likes to floss. So it ends up, this is part of the inflammation picture. Periodontal disease with a lot of chronic inflammation is an independent risk factor for heart problems and stroke. And they think the connection is because there's ongoing chronic inflammation. So people with gum disease are 2 times more likely to develop diabetes, and more than 50 studies and 4 meta-analyses link periodontal disease with increased blood markers of inflammation. So flossing is a good thing. One epidemiologist estimated that it'll add 18 months to your lifespan. So go get that floss out. Okay, getting adequate sleep. We slept about 9 hours a night at the turn of the century. Most of us now sleep probably 7, maybe even a little less. And Bill Clinton was proud of sleeping only 5 or 6 hours a night. But look what that did to him. This is Bill nodding off at a Martin Luther King speech. And the subtitle was, "I Had a Dream." I loved it. I loved it. So how much sleep do you really need? Well, it differs for each of us. It's actually the amount that you need to feel really rested and alert during the day, and that if you were given a nice dark room in a, you know, at 3 o'clock, would you not fall asleep? The average, most of the sleep societies estimate you need about 8 to 8.5. I'm going to guess that many of us in this room are not getting that. That range, though, is quite large, 4 to 11. And there was even a special program on this English guy during the World War II who actually needed like 1 hour of sleep, and it was real. But most of the time we think we can undersleep and get away with it, but it's probably more genetically determined than we think. And most sleep specialists feel that you really can't learn to adapt to less sleep than your bodies need without paying a price. And that price is quite substantial. People who are chronically sleep deprived, rocket science, don't do as well at school and work. They have increasing automobile accidents. They don't do as well on memory tests. Interesting, if you have a chronic pain condition and you have chronic insomnia, it is much worse. They've done studies where they've had people in the lab. They give them a little bit of a heat thing, you know, okay, tell me when it's too bad, all right. And then they sleep deprive them, and they come back and they test them with the same pain stimulus. They have a much lower threshold for feeling the pain when they're sleep deprived. So, and unfortunately, pain keeps you from sleeping, so it's kind of a bad cycle. You get increased aggressive behavior some of the time, certainly increased health costs, and either end of the spectrum, if you chronically undersleep or chronically oversleep, you are likely to have increased mortality. And this, I think, is one of the most compelling things, and it goes back to a lot of what I was talking about with obesity. There seems to be a really strong sleep-obesity connection. So subjects who are sleep-deprived, guess what happens? Your appetite goes up. You know, when you've, at least in college, I can see it with the med students and the residents. You know, they're eating, they want to go for the ugly food. They're tired after staying up all night for their exam. They go for the fat and the sugar. And they did a study where they had healthy medical students in a sleep lab, and they didn't wake them up, but they made sure that they didn't get into a deep sleep for 3 days. And they had as bad sugars as some pre-diabetics after just 3 days of sleep deprivation. And one of the reasons this may be happening is that melatonin, you know, the hormone made in the pineal gland, which helps regulate our circadian rhythm, there may be actually melatonin receptors not just in the brain, but on the pancreas, and the pancreas is the organ that makes insulin. So we are very complicated and hardwired, but most people would say getting a decent night's sleep is going to be really good for your health. And there's some strategies. You've all heard some of these probably in the press. And if you're an Olympic sleeper and you don't do any of these, that I don't care. These are recommendations for people who are really having trouble sleeping. For instance, you want to get up and go to sleep at the same time. The role of light is really interesting. You don't want to be trying to fall asleep in a really brightly lit room because that's going to inhibit the amount of melatonin. Conversely, if you're one of those really slow in the morning people, you might want to get some light going so that that's going to help you wake up and lower your melatonin levels. Certainly, caffeine and alcohol are often not considered good. Exercising regularly, they claim not before bedtime. I love to exercise before bed. So, I mean, again, I generally don't have trouble sleeping, so I don't need to follow these as closely. This is interesting. You want to have not all the things that you're used to, like the TV going, the radio on, you know, your PDA, your cell phone. Guess what the average number of devices in a teenager's room is? Electronic devices. 8. TV, you know, cell phone, computer, oh my goodness. So turning those all off. And then finally trying to sort of do some of this letting go and letting some of that chatter of the day go. And then only going to bed when you're sleepy. If you're lying in bed and you're wide awake and you're going, oh my goodness, what did I not get on the shopping list? And I'm going to be too tired for work tomorrow. Get up, leave your bedroom, go do something until you are sleepy and come back. They really want you to associate sleeping in your bed with just being intimate with a partner, if that's appropriate, or going to sleep. Okay. I'm sorry?
You had 5
there. Oh, I clumped them. Oh, you are, somebody is really paying attention. You are not sleep deprived, or at least if you are, you've had some caffeine. That's great. I'm sorry, there were 6 originally, and I actually edited them, and I didn't change that. So thank you. I'll make it 5 strategies. Great. So these are some resources, great resources if you are interested in sleep. So we're getting down there. Okay, managing stress, and I know you've had just fabulous talks in this last couple of weeks about this. So I'm going to go through these a little bit quicker. I love, this was a very wise patient of mine who said, you know, I realized I can't eliminate the stress in my life, but what I can do is control how I respond to it. So I just want to say stress is really how you define it. And one person's stress is another person's hobby. So 3 of these would put me into a fight or flight reaction. And 3 of them kind of make me happy. But these are all things that might be either hobbies or things that you wouldn't want to do. So I would not be sitting on this girder. Not a chance. Get me skydiving, you'd have to put me in general anesthesia. Put me in a tight place, dark place, like a cave. Oh, no. But I love spiders. I like talking. That's actually giving a public speech is the major way in the lab they create stress for most people. And I actually really enjoy doing it. And then they also make people do math problems when they want to stress them. I'm kind of a geek and I like doing math. So for me, these other 3 are fine, these 3 not. And I would guess that each of you is going to have a different description about what stresses you and what doesn't. So you've had already 2 lectures a little bit about this. But again, we evolved to be able to respond quickly and effectively to acute stress. And if we didn't, we wouldn't be here. So again, the zebra running away from the tiger or the lion, she wants to be able to do energy now. Her blood pressure goes up. Her heart gets increased. She shuts down everything that's not essential, including growth, reproduction, digestion. And that's great. And guess what? 10 minutes after the lion's gone, the zebra is sitting there chill, munching on the savanna grass. That's not you and me. And the reason I love it, Robert Sapolsky actually wrote a book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, is that we have a brain that allows us to continue to think that we're constantly under stress. We feel like that tiger or the lion is with us most of the time. So we can't damp down this, and instead we keep this fight or flight system activated for months. I love it, worrying about mortgages, relationships, and promotions. I'm going to just skip that. So what constitutes stress, though, for most people, and I'm going to guess this fits for you, and Dr. Moskowitz talked a little bit about this the last lecture. This was 800 industry workers in Finland, and they looked at them at baseline, and they didn't have heart disease, and they followed them for 25 years. And those who had the following things that were perceived as stressful to them had a double chance of dying from heart disease at the end of 25 years. So the things that generally make people go nuts are, I have no control over this situation. That's a big one. It's too much. I'm overwhelmed. I can't possibly finish everything I'm being asked to do. And I'm not getting rewarded. Nobody's seeing the amount of effort and all the overwork that I'm doing. And then I also feel challenged and threatened. And those are, and then if you add in social isolation, you've got just a cocktail that's pretty deadly in terms of how we respond, how we perceive, and how that might get to a chronic situation. I'm just going to skip. The relaxation response to me is the opposite of this fight or flight. It calms the body down. Everything is great. So I want to talk about how you can do this in your life. And there are really many paths to this, and it really doesn't, it may be individually something very different. For me, it's walking in on a trail in the forest or, you know, up on the ridge in Marin County. A major common denominator is slow diaphragmatic breathing, where you just slow your breathing down and you imagine the air going into your stomach first and then into your chest and then out. And there are many other things. I'm going to talk a tiny bit about meditation, but you can imagine a whole range. For some, it's music. For some, it's prayer. For some, it's doing exercise. So each one of us has many paths to mobilize this relaxation response. And guess what? When you do, the stress genes get turned off. I mean, the unhealthy genes that were similar to those studied in the prostate cancer, they get turned off. This was 19 subjects who were really experienced in some form of eliciting the relaxation response, and they had decreased activity of the genes, again, associated with inflammation, not good, programmed cell death, and how the body manages these reactive oxygen species. So it's a good thing. And most of us know that meditation intuitively is a sort of slowing down. That's a nice path for some people. But we now have neuroimaging that really shows us, yes, that's true. Brain regions that are associated with the ability to be to attend to something, to stay focused, and to process things are bigger, literally bigger, in people who are experienced meditators. They grow because they're being stimulated. And look at this, the reward and motivation centers are activated when somebody starts to meditate. You maybe don't need that junk food diet. Maybe you need, you know, a meditative practice. And finally, expert meditators, people who have been doing this for years, when they put them in the scanner and they give them like a loud noise or something else, they don't react as much on their brain scans. So meditation, I think, is a good path for many people. But you don't necessarily need to go to the cave in India for 20 years. I just wanted to give you some examples of some things you can buy on the internet, which will give you a little bit of a fun feedback. These are stress dots. You put them on your fingers or your wrist. And what it does is it checks the temperature. And have you ever noticed when you're really relaxed, do your hands get warmer or colder?
Warmer.
Guess what? That's this, you know, you've just done the relaxation response. There's more blood flow to your hands. So you can compare the dot color based on whether or not you've got a nice warm hand. If you're a little bit more quantitative, you can buy this temperature trainer online, and you just literally with a piece of scotch tape put that on, and you can actually see the temperature of your hands. And anything you do that helps increase this temperature is going to give you practice in eliciting this relaxation response. I'm actually going to, yes? For popsicle toes? Oh, that's great. So you mean like when you're really frozen, when you have cold feet?
Yeah.
That's another issue. Certainly relaxation makes my feet a little bit warmer, but I'm like those of us who are not blessed with warm feet, this may not extend down to the toes. But being relaxed is going to be a good thing no matter whether it makes your popsicle toes go away. Okay. So I just want to say reflecting is part of this as well. This was an incredibly simple experiment. Subjects were just asked, given a piece of paper and pencil, and said, write for 4 days in a row, just for 20 minutes, about an upsetting experience. Try and really think about what happened and, you know, why it went well or why it didn't go well. And what happened was just with taking that time to reflect, they reported less stress. Asthma patients actually breathed better in a physical way. Rheumatoid arthritis patients felt less pain. It's amazing. And I think this more argues for the fact that we so don't take the time to just be quiet. We're inundated with all this information, with the TV. There's not a time, except if I'm in the High Sierra, when I'm not reachable by some electronic device. And it's, you know, that's not necessarily so good. Obviously, the serenity prayer, accepting things, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change, to change the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. This is a life's work. So I just want to finish off this one thing about managing stress and say that there are many advantages to think about finding your individual path that's going to help elicit your relaxation response. I must admit, some of these are very easily taught, and it's not so easy to sit down and try and meditate every day. I've been doing it for years, and every single time for about the first 10 minutes, the grocery list is there, you know, oh, my butt hurts, I'm not going to sit here, you know, all of that. So that's part of the human condition. So not everything is easily done, but many of these things are inexpensive, safe, easy, and will easily complement the other things you're doing for your health. Okay, I'm actually going to go super fast through this because you had a whole fabulous lecture from Dr. Moskowitz about positive emotions. So, but this, I do have to say this. Look at this guy. I love him. He looks like a nasty soul. And this gets back to, I had a couple of classmates in medical school who were not nice. I didn't like being near them. I couldn't imagine being a patient of one. And now I find out that they're getting justice is being done, maybe. Okay. So they have studied long-term, and it was at Harvard, sorry. They studied some medical students, and they measured them at the beginning of med school, and they found out, ooh, there's some that are sort of hostile, and there's some that are pretty relaxed. So in these students, 10 years later, they followed them. If they had high hostility scores, guess what? They had more cardiovascular disease. And this was, some of you maybe, you've heard the type A behavior. Well, Meyer Friedman was here at UCSF, and he actually tried to take a bunch of type A driven type executives, and he tried to sort of change them by randomizing them to this, stress management and many other things. And in the group, usual care, about over a quarter of them had a problem with their heart. They'd all had heart problems before. The ones that just got group counseling, just kind of, okay, here, you know, you shouldn't feel that stressed, did not much better. But look, the type A group that had the real intervention to try and relax some of this hostility, manage their anger, had much less recurrence. So I think it's effective. Dr. Moskowitz talked a lot about positive psychology. This is sort of interesting to me. Like, do you know, there are people in your family or in your lives that are just constitutionally happy. You know, glasses overflowing all the time. And you just go, I want some of that. My family, the glass didn't have any water in it at all. So when I looked at this and I found out that my happiness set point, at least by Sonia Lubomirsky, who's a great researcher, is 50% hardwired, I have my work cut out for me. So, but 10% seems to be environment, and 40%, this same 40%, I have some control over. So I can say I am blessed to have been surrounded by some incredibly positive people for whom the glass is not unrealistically overflowing. And after years of sort of just being close to them, I'm realizing that there's another way to look at life. And it's not money, power, prestige, property. If you're above the poverty line, if you're above more than the poverty line, adding more money in studies has not proven to increase your happiness. Usually what increases your happiness is all the rest of the recommendations that I'm going to give you in a second. This, if you haven't been aware, there are two incredible centers in the Bay Area that are studying all of this field. And the UC Berkeley Greater Good Science Center, I think I put that on as a reference, is a fabulous group. And Dacher Keltner wrote this terrifically interesting book called Born to Be Good. He's just doing wonderful, wonderful work about increasing the positive affect and way that people go through the world. I'm just going to go through this very quickly. Okay. Stay connected. All right. This is one of the most powerful predictors of good health. So meaningful relationships, either platonic, romantic, familial, are the most consistent predictor of quality of life. So when you think about it, on, you know, God forbid, on your deathbed, are you going to say, you know, it was that $100,000 more I made, you know, 2 years ago that gave my life meaning? No, it's probably going to be the people you love most deeply in your life. And it is. It's a huge. So not only is there a positive protective effect when you have those relationships, but unfortunately, if you're isolated and lonely, there are some health problems associated with this. So you are 3 to 7 times more likely to die if you are consistently lonely, depressed, and isolated. And that's even after you control for, you know, what your cholesterol is, whether you smoke, whether or not you exercise. So it's very, very powerful. And this is so sad to me. I honestly still don't believe this data. 1 out of 4 Americans who were surveyed in this 2004 talked to no one about something of importance in the previous 6 months. That's just breathtaking to me. And we have other data. Medical students who report they're a little more isolated or lonely have lower immunity, get more colds. And social isolation is a risk for recurrence and progression in a 17-year forward study of people with breast cancer. So social connectedness or the lack thereof is very powerful for your health. And it may not take a whole lot. They did a study in Alameda County where they followed people for years. And social connectedness was protective against mortality. And it, social connectedness was as little as going bowling once a month with your league. I mean, that's not like, you know, huge social contact. Belong to a book club. Go, you know, I go to a weekly aquarobics class, and I realize that I miss when the women who usually come aren't there, and they actually know that I'm not there when I'm not. And I'm, it's just sort of like a little bit of an extra connection. And even being recognized by name by the person at Starbucks in one study made a difference in somebody's happiness. The woman at the gym that I go to finally has figured out who I am because I come at the same time every day. And she's now saying, "Hi, Ellen." Well, I, you know, I just went, "Hi, Veronica." You know, so now she's going to make my day. I'm going to make hers, you know. And every time I leave now, she says, "Bye, Ellen." And I'm just feeling like, wow, I think I'll come here more often. So these last two are really important. So, and I sort of lump them, but they're not, they're sort of different. Engage in activities that have meaning for you and connect with something beyond you. So many of you are aware that Viktor Frankl wrote this amazing book called Man's Search for Meaning, which was a lot about survival through the period of the Holocaust. And I love his quote, "Life has a meaning to the last breath. The possibility of realizing values exists to the very last moment." And people who have a sense of why to live can bear almost any how. So there are two sides to this. So you can choose to fill your life with stuff that's not quite so important, or you can choose to populate it with activities that have meaning. So that's one part of it. But you can also add meaning to all the other things that you do that you might not think of as very inspiring. So, and we are also an incredibly generous society. Americans give and volunteer more than almost any other society in the world. And a recent study from one of my former medical students, he looked at, you know, he studied vets. You don't think of vets, you know, as big volunteers, but some of them did, and those that did lived longer and reported greater life satisfaction. And people are actually happier when they give. They've done experiments where they'll give people $15 or $20, and they say, "Spend it on yourself or give it away," and then they check how happy they are 2 days later, and the people who gave it away are much happier. So I think, you know, when we think of other people and extend ourselves, it's a very positive thing for our health. And finally, connecting with whatever is greater than yourself. For many of you in this audience, it may be a spiritual presence, God or whatever, but it doesn't have to be. It can be nature, it can be a cause, it can be just anything that feels like it's larger than your specific life. And when people have that sense of connectedness, they often enjoy greater health and happiness. And one of the, I just wanted to review the spirituality literature. Most of the time they measure this by church attendance or mosque attendance or whatever, but it's clear that people who go to church on a regular basis or have some regular spiritual practice are healthier. More than 50 peer-reviewed studies show that regular religious attendance is associated with better health. I'll just let you read the rest of that. Okay, so this is the end. I just want you to realize that we've gone through quite a lot, some of it more sort of straightforward lifestyle kinds of stuff. I hope some of the other stuff that we've talked about makes you think a little bit about the changes that you would like to make in your life to improve your sense of well-being, and maybe even that you're going to live longer and better. So I wanted to say, just to recap, we talked a lot in the beginning about the new science of aging, and I hope that wasn't too, complicated, but I'm so excited because I think you're going to be hearing more about how this basic science supports these other 10 recommendations. We talked how diet, lifestyle stuff really impacts health. And the best news of all to me is that you make these changes, you're going to see effects on your health very quickly, much more quickly than we ever had a thought. And I don't want you to forget the powerful role that connection with people you love, positive outlook, and meaning have on your well-being. So I really hope you'll take, let's take 5 seconds to just sit and quietly think, what's one change you'd like to make this week based on maybe some of the things we've talked about? Just take 5 seconds. And sometimes telling a loved one what you've decided to do helps that happen. So maybe you can share that with whomever you'd like to later on this week. And then finally, I hope that you'll better appreciate there are some real benefits. No, I'm serious. Old Stradivarius violins get better with age. So does cheese and wine. Redwoods are are very wonderful. And you still, I'm almost 65, so I'm going to get my senior discount soon. So, and I just want to say how grateful I am that you've been such a great audience, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Ask away. Yes, in the back.
Yeah, I'm wondering if longevity, have there been any studies on how this may affect the prevalence of dementia?
Ooh, so very good question. Have the longer we live physically, what's going to happen with the incidence of dementia? And that's why that staying mentally so all of the things that I recommended in terms of lifestyle for your heart and for diabetes are good for the brain. But you are absolutely right. The National Institutes of Health have a whole institute on aging, and they really are interested, not just from an economic point of view, that we're going to have needs for a lot of extra nursing care if people develop dementia and start to live to 90 to 100. So that's why I'm so excited about the lecture. I think there are ways that you can prevent that or slow that or reduce your chances of getting it if you follow even some of the advice here. But so anything to think about in terms of, I said, stay mentally active, but all the other lifestyle things, exercise, healthy diet, all of that will also impact your ability to stay as cognitively clear as possible. But great question. Yeah.
Why is that Africans eat 1 kilo or 2 kilos of grain a day but not get fat?
Okay. Well, guess what kind of grain they eat? You bet. So her question was, what about in populations or societies where they eat just all of this grain and they're not getting fat? First of all, they're running on the savanna, so most of them are much more physically active. But the whole grain is probably what's happening, is that it's not that high glycemic instant, sugar load into the system. It's not refined. It's whole food has a lot to do with it. Yeah. in the pink. Uh-huh. No, I'm sorry. Oh, you're both sort of pink. No, in the back, and then we'll do you.
I think you mean pink.
Yes.
Oh, when you throw things into the blender, does that reduce their fiber?
Oh, great question. So what kinds of things are you thinking about throwing into the blender?
Well, fruit, things like that.
Yeah.
But also grain.
Yeah, probably momentarily, but that's going to happen in your digestive system as well with the digestive acids. But it just means I don't think it's going to break it up so much that, especially if you drink it or whatever right afterwards, that it's going to be a problem. Because if you have like the whole apple, you're going to have all that fiber. Even if you juice it, if you eat the juice and the pulp and all the stuff, you're getting the whole apple. You're just getting it in the liquid form, and that should be fine. Okay, and you had a question?
Just can I ask, when I walk into the grocery store and I look for bread, there are 10,000 varieties and they all are healthy.
Oh, you just, and yes, yeah, so she's right. She said you're looking for, yes.
Beckman's farmer's bread, I think there's nothing in it but whole wheat.
Great.
I hope.
Okay, so you just said whole wheat. So let me... Yeah. First of all, have you read about how now Cocoa Puffs have a heart healthy... I'm sorry. I have nothing to do with Cocoa Puffs, but there should be better labeling. But if you see whole wheat, that's not the same as whole grain. So you actually, in a product, would want to see the seeds. You actually want to see something that it came from. But it has to say whole grain would be a place to start. But I agree with you. It's like, and they're all brown. And some of that's just molasses added back. You know, it's not necessarily the fiber. And you're going to know, because if you eat really whole grain, very fiber-rich food, your system's going to tell you in a positive way. You're going to know that your digestion and your elimination is improved. It's hard. It is so hard to read food labels. Yep. Yep. Okay, here.
Yeah, those of us who train for backpacking trips or follow, you know, all the recommendations,
yes,
tend to also be very goal-oriented.
Yes.
Type A.
Yeah.
Could you comment on
Yeah. Okay. So she was saying those people, and I imagine you're speaking for yourself, who follow many of these healthy lifestyle things and go backpacking, are little driven. Yes. Yeah. And you can over... So it depends on how you perceive this. I can imagine two people training for an Ironman marathon, you know, Ironman competition, and one of them is so stressed out, and the other one is seeing it as a joyful possibility. So what really matters is less the behavior, although you certainly can compulsively exercise, and that's not good. You'll literally break your muscles down or injure yourself. But it's more your interior landscape. And can you approach it in this very graceful sort of Aikido way and say, what a wonderful opportunity, versus, oh, my God, I couldn't run today because of the rain. Does that make sense? So I think if you can damp down a little bit that sort of driven, a little drive is great. You know, if the medical students, if you did a personality inventory of most medical students and lawyer students and stuff, we're way on the end of goal-oriented, you know. You have to be to make it to this stage. The issue is, can you turn the volume down enough so that it's not unhealthy for you? So I like having, you know, there are times when I need the volume up if I've got a bad deadline, but if I can't turn it down again, that's when I turn into all of, you know, the things that aren't good for my health. So I know it's late. Does anybody know, this is terrible. Does anybody have a PDA or something that can check the World Series result? The Phillies. Okay. Anyway, thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.